Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Refugees deserve support and solidarity, not closed borders and pushbacks. That's a reminder from UN Chief Antonio Guterres on Tuesday's World Refugee Day regarding the international community's duty to assist and protect refugees. With forced displacement at a record high of 110 million people around the world, Mr. Guterres called for more solutions to resettle refugees and help them rebuild their lives. He also stressed the need for solidarity with host countries and communities. From Kenya, UN Refugee Chief Filippo Grandi said that the world should step up investment and commit to including refugees in our communities at all levels, in our schools, workplaces, healthcare systems, and beyond. In a tweet, Mr. Grandi deplored the fact that this year's World Refugee Day coincided with the news that more than 500,000 people have now fled Sudan to neighboring countries. Guns must fall silent if we want this exodus to stop, he said. UN humanitarians issued an urgent appeal on Tuesday to help millions of people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, where chronic violence and displacement continue to fuel a dramatic hunger crisis. According to the UN World Food Programme, WFP, since March 2022 alone, 5.7 million people have been displaced in the eastern provinces of North Kivu, South Kivu, and Ituri. Displacement has spurred food insecurity as people are driven off their land and left unable to grow crops. Here's WFP spokesperson for Southern Africa, Thompson Piri.
The country is continental in size, with acres of space, but millions of people have no choice but to live in very overcrowded and squalid camps. DRC has the highest number of food insecure people worldwide. Approximately 25.8 million people will face acute food insecurity in 2023.
Mr. Piri called the DRC a forgotten crisis and said that so far this year, only 15% of the $870 million required for WFP's humanitarian response in the country has been sourced. Lebanon's extreme economic crisis has almost entirely eroded people's ability to cope, with dramatic consequences for the youngest generation's health and well-being, the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, said on Tuesday. The UN agency's latest assessment shows that after 4 years of crisis, 9 out of 10 families no longer have money to cover basic expenses, and the majority have cut spending on healthcare and education. Public services in the country are on the verge of collapse. Almost 1 in 3 children has gone to bed hungry in the past month, according to UNICEF, and some 10% of youngsters have to work in order to help provide for their families. Among Syrian refugees living in the country, more than 1 in every 4 children works. The crisis has also taken a very severe toll on children's mental health, UNICEF said, with half of all parents saying that their children often appear depressed. The agency called for urgent investment in social protection and cash support for families with young children, as well as funding for schools, healthcare, water infrastructure, and child protection services. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
Let's talk about
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Common side effects include heart failure, persistent fever, bruising, bleeding, lymphoma, nervous system, and blood disorders.
The message is now part of and registered in your subconscious mind. Every time you say, see, hear, or think.
Radio Free Kansas.
That's your key phrase. It will trigger the entire message without you being aware of it.
Oh, man, that is just wrong.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
It's a fool who looks for logic in the chambers of the human heart.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County.
John Piljo.
You may remember the terrible road of death. The Iraqi army tried to escape the wrath of the U.S. in Kuwait. Miles and miles of vehicles of fleeing Iraqi military personnel were blown to bits. Most of the ammunition, most of the ordnance used was depleted uranium.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
Good afternoon, listeners. That's right. That'll be in the second hour, PUC Radio, with John Pilger. Now, he's an Australian journalist, getting rather old these days, as we all are. But he has been around a long time. John Pilger is a very interesting journalist. He's been right many more times than he has been wrong. However, he's just a journalist, and you have to listen to what he says carefully and, you know, drill down, do your own research, and see what if you agree with him or not on his conclusions, if any, in the second hour, courtesy Mariah Gallardon, who is graciously allowed us to rebroadcast her work from North California and her off-the-grid home she and her friends made up there. Well, today it's going to be up to 89, 90 degrees again. It's a scorcher weather-wise here in northeast Kansas. But yet we are not in a drought. Strangely, northeast Kansas represents, there's a, oh, I don't know, a diamond shape geographically of the drought zones. And we are not in it. We are. Most of the state of Kansas is in a state of drought. We have not had much rain, even here locally, but enough to keep us out of drought. At least northeast Kansas and west to Topeka, the capital. You go any further west than that, you're going into a drought region, heavy, severe drought region. So, just thought I'd leave you that. Give you that. I'm not trying to upset you. However, it is weather on Wednesday, and we've got lots to do. We've got the latest coming up, the latest Democracy Now! From this morning. You know, I consider giving you these headlines as a starting point for you. It's on your lunch hour. Give you something to think about in the afternoon, and maybe later on in the evening you'll do some research on the story, on the headlines. And of course, you know, Democracy Now! Runs an hour. You're only receiving the headlines. The United Nations has a whole news department, and they do a lot of work all around the world. That's why you get these headlines. Keeps your head up, makes you keep you thinking about what's going on in the world. And after the latest Democracy Now!, Alex Smith's EcoShock, Radio EcoShock, which gives you many times, Alex has interviews with the best scientists on climate that he can get. And so he's very authoritative in his sourcing of his conclusions about climate change. I hope you listen to it. That'll be first, and then TUC will follow in the second hour. I hope you enjoy the show today. We do this mainly to keep the public informed and on its toes about burning issues, burning events that occur around the world, not just here in Kansas. And with that, I would like to turn over the switchboard and microphone. You could call in 646-716-8652 while the show is live, noon to 2. And the guy at the switchboard and at the mix board, Tristan, will take care of we'll see what we can do. If we can get you on the air, we might be able to. We might have a few minutes every day. We have a few minutes left over. You can call in, and Tristan will screen your call. We'll decide if we have enough time to put you on, or you can just visit in the green room. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Mike Cadell. Tristan, let's move on with the show.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge has struck down Arkansas's first-in-the-nation ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth. Judge James Moody Jr. ruled the ban to be unconstitutional because it discriminates against transgender people and violates the rights of doctors. In his decision, Moody wrote, quote, "Rather than protecting children or safeguarding medical ethics, the evidence showed the prohibited medical care improves the mental health and well-being of patients, and that by prohibiting it, the state undermined the interests it claims to be advancing," unquote. One of the plaintiffs who sued Arkansas over the ban was a 17-year-old trans student named Dylan Brandt, who responded to the ruling by saying, quote, "Transgender kids across the country are having their own futures threatened by laws like this one, and it's up to all of us to speak out, fight back, and give them hope," unquote. On Tuesday night, Israeli settlers raided 10 Palestinian villages in the occupied West Bank, setting fire to homes and vehicles. The attacks came hours after two Palestinian gunmen shot dead four Israelis and injured four others near a Jewish settlement. The alleged gunmen were later shot dead. The militant group Hamas said the attack was a response to Israel's massive air and ground raid on the Jenin refugee camp on Monday, during which Israel deployed U.S.-made Apache helicopter gunships for the first time in the West Bank in nearly two decades. The death toll from Israel's raid on the refugee camp reached seven today, following the death of a 15-year-old Palestinian girl named Sadil Natnia, who was shot by Israeli gunfire. Palestinians living in Jenin said they're now afraid to let their children go outside. This is Hadil Jass, whose husband was shot dead by Israeli forces Monday.
There's no safe place in the camp. At any minute, there could be a raid. We are afraid for our children to go outside. If I want to go to the market, I will be in a hurry to be back home so I can feel safe with my children at home.
In Honduras, at least 41 women were killed Tuesday after an attack by gang members inside a women's prison in the town of Tamara. Reports say the women had repeatedly complained about receiving threats from gangs inside the prison but were ignored. Some of the women were burned to death. Others were stabbed and shot. Relatives of the victims are demanding justice.
We want to know who are alive because they're human beings. They are our family. We want to see them and know how they are. If all of the authorities are quiet, what are we doing here? Staying silent as well? No, we want answers.
Honduran President Xiomara Castro, the first female president of Honduras, has fired Honduras' security minister, accusing prison authorities of aiding gang members in the massacre. Federal police in Brazil have revealed a top aide to former right-wing President Jair Bolsonaro had gathered documents outlining plans to stage a possible military coup last year after Bolsonaro was defeated by Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Brazilian police found the planning documents on the phone of Lieutenant Colonel Mauro Cid, who was arrested last month for his role in falsifying Bolsonaro's COVID-19 vaccination records. The Pentagon has announced accounting errors have freed up an additional $6.2 billion to spend on arms for Ukraine. Last month, the Pentagon said it had made a $3 billion accounting error, but officials now say the error is twice as large due to the overestimation of the value of military aid packages. In news from Sudan, heavy fighting has resumed in the capital Khartoum after a 72-hour ceasefire expired. On Tuesday, the Sudanese military accused the Rapid Support Forces of bombing the country's intelligence headquarters. Meanwhile, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grande, says over 500,000 people have now fled Sudan since fighting began 2 months ago.
Today, right on World Refugee Day, we passed this horrible mark of 500,000 refugees from Sudan. And we know why. The fighting is really generating this huge exodus, and if there is not going to be a sustainable ceasefire and then peace, I don't think that we will see an end to it. People will continue to be displaced inside or go outside. In fact, in addition to the 500,000, there are almost 2 million that have moved inside the country because they have nowhere else to go.
Amnesty International is urging countries across the Americas to stop their racist treatment of Haitian asylum seekers as thousands continue to flee Haiti due to worsening gang violence, extreme poverty, and a deteriorating political crisis. The group denounced the mass deportations, torture, detention, and violence faced by Haitians in the United States, Mexico, the Dominican Republic, Chile, and other nations where Haitians pass through in their search for protection. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi arrived in New York Tuesday to begin a four-day state visit. On Thursday, President Biden will hold a formal state dinner for Modi hours after he addresses a joint session of Congress. The Biden administration is attempting to strengthen ties to India as part of an effort to counter China's growing power in the Indo-Pacific region. Modi is head of the Hindu nationalist BJP party. He was once banned from the United States on charges he did not intervene in a massacre against Muslims in 2002 in the Indian state of Gujarat that he headed. At least three Democratic lawmakers plan to boycott Modi's address to Congress, Representatives Jamie Raskin, Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib. In a post on social media, Tlaib wrote, quote, "It's shameful that Modi has been given a platform at our nation's capital. His long history of human rights abuses, anti-democratic actions targeting Muslims and religious minorities, and censoring journalists is unacceptable," she said. Hunter Biden, the son of the president, has reached a deal with federal prosecutors to plead guilty to two misdemeanor tax charges as part of a deal that allow him to avoid facing prosecution on a separate gun charge. The deal caps a multi-year investigation by the U.S. attorney in Delaware, who is appointed by Donald Trump, but allowed to stay in his role by President Biden. House Republicans have described the deal as a slap on the wrist and a vow to continue to investigate Hunter Biden and his overseas business ventures. A disciplinary hearing has begun in California for attorney John Eastman, who advised Donald Trump on ways to overturn the 2020 election. At the time, Eastman was the dean of the Chapman University Law School in Southern California. Eastman faces 11 disciplinary charges in the State Bar Court of California. The process could lead to his disbarment. The federal judge overseeing Donald Trump's trial for mishandling classified documents has set an initial trial date of August 14th, 1 week before the first Republican presidential debate. U.S. District Court Judge Aileen Cannon set the date on Tuesday, but many legal experts expect the trial will be delayed. Cannon's a Trump-appointed judge who served on the federal bench for less than 3 years. According to the New York Times, she's only overseen four short criminal trials in her time on the bench. In labor news, Senator Bernie Sanders has launched a Senate investigation into the dangerous working conditions at Amazon warehouses. In a letter to Amazon Chief Executive Officer Andy Jassy, Sanders wrote, quote, "Amazon is one of the most valuable companies in the world, worth $1.3 trillion, and its founder, Jeff Bezos, is one of the richest men in the world, worth nearly $150 billion. Amazon should be one of the safest places in America to work, not one of the most dangerous," Sanders said. ProPublica has revealed Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito took an undisclosed luxury fishing vacation with Republican megadonor Paul Singer in 2008 and then later ruled in Singer's favor in several cases. According to ProPublica, the billionaire hedge fund manager gave Alito a free ride on his luxury jet to Alaska for a trip where one participant bragged about drinking $1,000 bottles of wine. Alito never reported the all-expenses-paid trip on disclosure forms. Since the trip, Paul Singer's hedge fund came before the Supreme Court at least 10 times, and Alito never recused himself. ProPublica reports Alito's trip was organized by Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society, who's played a key role in pushing the court to the right. Hours prior to the publication of ProPublica's report, Alito published a column in the Wall Street Journal headlined, "ProPublica Misleads Its Readers." In the piece, Justice Alito acknowledged taking the trip but denied violating any ethics rules. Heat records continue to be shattered in Texas and Mexico as a massive heat dome remains over the region. In San Angelo, Texas, temperatures reached 114 degrees Fahrenheit Tuesday, breaking the old record by 3 degrees. In Laredo, temperatures hit 115 degrees Monday, according to the organization Climate Central. Climate change is making the extreme heat five times as likely to occur in parts of Texas. On this first day of summer, meteorologists are taking part in the sixth annual Show Your Stripes Day to raise awareness about the link between weather and the climate crisis. A massive search effort continues in the Atlantic Ocean after a tourist submersible went missing during a trip to explore the wreck of the Titanic, which sits over 12,000 feet below sea level. Five passengers are on board, including the founder of OceanGate Expeditions, which organized the trip. For years, the company ignored warnings by its own staff and experts that the company's deep water missions could lead to a catastrophe because the submarine did not meet industry standards. Tickets for the mission reportedly cost $250,000 each. Passengers aboard the ship include two billionaires, Hamish Harding from Britain and Shahzada Dawood from Pakistan, who is on board with his son. And many are questioning the massive media coverage of the Titanic adventurers in light of the lack of attention paid to the thousands of migrants lost at sea as they attempt to reach Europe, fleeing persecution, poverty, and the impacts of the climate crisis in their home countries. This comes as authorities in Greece have recovered three more bodies of men who drowned last week in one of the deadliest migrant shipwrecks in years. The official death toll is 81, but the New York Times reports as many as 700 migrants may have died when their overcrowded ship sank off the coast of Greece. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour, every Saturday, 12 p.m., where we broadcast the news that you won't find on cable. Ever wonder what Gen Z is up to? Have you heard of Generation U? Ever wonder why the old geezers are excited that something's going on since their days of living underground and avoiding the Vietnam draft? We cover these topics on the Abolitionist Hour, and we kind of give you updates on the front, whether it's Atlanta, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Kansas City. We'll keep you updated on news and information on the state of dismal prison conditions and why the Jackson County Jail is not just a stockade, it's a phone company. So join us at the Abolitionist Hour, only on Blog Talk Radio, 12 p.m. Central Standard Time. We'll see you there.
And from the plains of Wyoming, drunk men came hurrying through. While Britannia's Huns with their long-range guns came in through the foggy dew. Back to the glen I rode again, and my heart with grief was sore. For I parted them with valiant whom I never shall see more.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Feeling uncomfortable? Extreme heat is bubbling up all over the world. Searing temperatures are back in India. They never left China and Southeast Asia. Now it's Mexico setting up cooling centers and sweating it out. France and Spain are cooking. Maps showing high ocean temperatures literally around the world are really scary. Fortunately, there is a solution. Just pretend it isn't happening. There, fixed it. But what if you suffer from I still see reality syndrome? Oh, that's too bad. You feel like the only one awake in the slumber room of mass media and social fantasy? That is why, as global climate negotiators backpedal into loving methane and carrying on drilling, that is why it is refreshing to hear at least one voice of authority calling them out. Last week, the Secretary General of the United Nations did not meet with the CEOs of big oil companies. Following yet another failed climate negotiating session in Bonn, Germany, UN Chief Antonio Guterres met with major climate campaigners instead. On June 15, he came out swinging in a press conference in New York City. You need to hear this. It's just 10 minutes of truth you will not hear on TV.
We are months away from the SDG, the Climate Ambition Summit,
with COP28 following soon after. And I am very worried where the world stands on climate. Countries are far off track in meeting climate promises and commitments. I see a lack of ambition, a lack of trust, a lack of support, a lack of cooperation, and an abundance of problems around clarity and credibility. The climate agenda is being undermined. At a time when we should be accelerating action, there is backtracking. At a time when we should be filling gaps, these gaps are growing. And meanwhile, the human rights of climate activists are being trampled. The most vulnerable are suffering the most. Current policies are taking the world to a 2.8-degree temperature rise by the end of the century. That spells catastrophe, yet the collective response remains pitiful. We are hurtling towards disaster, eyes wide open, with far too many willing it all on wishful thinking, unproven technologies, and silver bullet solutions. It's time to wake up and step up. It's time to rebuild trust based on climate justice. It's time to accelerate the just transition to a green economy. Limiting the rise in global temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius is still possible. We must consider this as a moment of hope. But it will require carbon emissions to be cut by 45% by 2030. To help get us there, I have proposed the Climate Solidarity Pact, in which all big emitters would make extra efforts to cut emissions, and wealthier countries supporting emerging economies to do so. And I have put forward an acceleration agenda to supercharge these efforts. I urge governments to make it happen by hitting fast forward on their net zero deadlines so that developed countries can meet to reach net zero as close as possible to 2040 and emerging economies as close as possible to 2050. And developed countries must abide by their commitments on finance, adaptation, and loss and damage. And they must also push multilateral development banks to adapt their business models, skill sets, and approaches to risk in order to leverage far more private finance at reasonable cost to developing countries to allow for a massive increase in investment in renewables. That investment is the only way to achieve global energy security independent of the present unpredictable market fluctuations. And in every country, without exception, civil society voices must be heard. They must be at the table helping to shape policy and on the ground helping to deliver change. All of this action must be global, it must be immediate, and it must start with the polluted heart of the climate crisis, the fossil fuel industry. Let's face facts. The problem is not simply fossil fuel emissions. It's fossil fuels, period. The solution is clear. The world must phase out fossil fuels in a just and equitable way, moving to leave oil, coal and gas in the ground where they belong, and massively boosting renewable investment in a just transition. Fossil fuel industry transition plans must be transformation plans that chart a company's move to clean energy and away from a product incompatible with human survival. Otherwise, they are just proposals to become more efficient planet wreckers. Of course, we must recognize that transformations don't happen overnight. Transition plans are precisely to provide a roadmap for a managed, orderly process that guarantees affordability, access, and energy security. How do we get there? Our acceleration agenda calls on governments to commit to no new coal, complete phasing out coal by 2030 in OECD countries and 2040 elsewhere, and all international coal funding, both public and private, and then licensing or funding of new oil and gas, stopping the expansion of existing oil and gas reserves, and supporting the just transition of the impacted developing countries. Ensure net zero electricity generation by 2035 in developed countries and 2040 everywhere else. And shift subsidies from fossil fuels to renewables and to a just energy transition. Put a price on carbon and establish a progressive global phase-out of existing oil and gas production compatible with global net zero emissions by 2050. But the fossil fuel industry and its enablers have a special responsibility. Last year, the oil and gas industry reaped a record $4 trillion US dollars windfall in net income. Yet for every dollar it spends on oil and gas drilling and exploration, only 4 cents went to clean energy and carbon capture combined. Trading the future for 30 pieces of silver is immoral. The world needs the industry to apply its massive resources to drive, not obstruct, the global move from fossil fuels to renewables and reap the benefits if they themselves lead the transition. Yet, right now, the industry is not even reaching the very low operational emissions reduction targets it has set for itself. Many are running late, and most rely on dubious offsets. I call on all fossil fuel companies to present credible, comprehensive, and detailed new transition plans, fully in line with all the recommendations of my high-level expert group on net zero pledges. These plans must cover all activities up and down the value chain. That must include reducing emissions from production, processing, transmission, refining, distribution, and use. And they must establish clear near-term targets that chart the business transition to clean energy. Fossil fuel companies must also cease and desist influence peddling and legal threats designed to kneecap progress. I'm thinking particularly of recent attempts to subvert net zero alliances invoking antitrust legislations. Governments are pivotal in setting the record straight. They must help by providing clear reassurance. Collective climate action does not violate antitrust, it upholds the public trust. At the same time, financial institutions must encourage this transformation of the fossil fuel industry. I urge all financial institutions to present public, credible and detailed plans to transition their funding from fossil fuels to clean energy. Again, we know that this transition will not occur overnight. These plans should contain clear targets for 2025 and 2030. And they should include an explicit strategy to progressively strip out fossil fuel assets from their portfolios to ensure they become credibly net zero aligned. They must show how capital expenditure, research and development, and investments are aligned with net zero targets. And they must disclose all lobbying and policy engagement activities. Financial institutions everywhere must end lending, underwriting, and investments in coal anywhere, including new coal infrastructure, power plants, and mines. And they must commit to end financing and investment for exploration for new oil and gas fields and expansion of oil and gas reserves, investing instead in the just transition in the developing world. To those finance institutions already shifting from fossil fuels to renewables, I have a special message of hope and encouragement. Do not relent in the face of attacks on progress. You are doing the right thing. Keep going. As my discussion with civil society leaders today made clear, there is simply too much at stake for us to be silent. There is too much at risk for us to sit on the sidelines. Now must be the time for ambition and action, and I look forward to welcoming first movers and doers at my Climate Ambition Summit in September. The world is watching, and the planet can't wait.
That was Antonio Guterres speaking at the United Nations on June 15th, 2023. So in case you have not heard, the only world effort to save our climate has gone off the rail. I'm talking about the COP system. The conference in Bonn that's planning it agreed two things would not be on the agenda for COP28 in Abu Dhabi: a phase-out of fossil fuels and financing a just transition for developing countries. The two things we need to do most to stop extinction-level heat will not be on the agenda. By the way, COP28 president-designate Sultan Ahmed Al-Jubar is the CEO of the UAE state-owned Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, also known as ADNOC. He is part of a new line of defense by fossil fuel producers. They say, we don't need to stop using fossil fuels. No, we can't do that. We just need to reduce emissions with carbon capture and storage or some other technology, which I'm sure will develop anytime soon. As you will hear later in this program, the biggest companies, from Chevron to Shell, have mostly dropped their pretense of winding down their climate-killing products. There is no Beyond Petroleum for BP. Greg Atkin, editor of the Inside Gas Bulletin, adds more facts to the stark statements by Antonio Guterres. From the trillions of dollars made by fossil fuel companies last year, every dollar they spend on finding even more fossil fuels, they will spend 4 cents on developing renewables. It's just window dressing. And that is the opposite of what should be happening to save a livable planet. The fossil addicts are heading out to buy lots more drugs, enough to kill us all. But Guterres did offer a plan, a way to cut fossil dependency by 45% in just 7 years. That is what scientists know we need to have to do to survive, and you know that too. There is a plan. Also last week, a coalition of environmental groups announced worldwide protests for September 15 and 17. Even if you have never been to a protest, please mark those days on your calendar and consider what you can do in person or online to send a message to alleged climate negotiators. It is not okay to set the world on fire. We will not live with that. The global mobilization has 6 demands. I will pass on just 2 of them here. Number 1, no new fossil fuels, no new finance, public or private, no new approvals, licenses, permits, or extensions. The provision of sufficient consensual climate funding to realize this commitment should be made everywhere. Number 4, stop greenwashing and claiming that offsets, carbon capture and storage, or geoengineering are solutions to the climate crisis. There are lots more demands, and you can find out more in my show blog at ecoshock.org or check out the website www.priceofoil.org. Priceofoil.org.
Radio EcoShock.
To explain this worrying new sea ice science, we are joined by co-author Dr. Dirk Notz. Professor Notz leads the sea ice program at the University of Hamburg. He is Deputy Managing Director for the University Institute of Oceanography and a longtime specialist in the field. From Hamburg, Dirk Notz, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, it's good to hear you.
Well, very seldom do scientists say it's too late. How did your team come to that conclusion about saving summer sea ice in the Arctic?
Well, it's been a kind of frustrating experience looking into Arctic sea ice over the past, you know, say, 10, 15 years that I've been working in the field, because the ice has been dwindling more and more and more. And basically, since decades, scientists have predicted at some point it will be gone. And what we've now found in this new study is that realistically, in every emission scenario that we think could potentially unfold over the next years, the Arctic sea ice will disappear at least in some summers. So it's certainly not too late to save the ice from disappearing in all summers. For that, we need a lot of emissions. But it seems to be impossible realistically to avoid to have occasional ice-free summers at some point between 2030 and 2050.
In its 2021 report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change predicted sea ice would, quote, be practically ice-free near mid-century under intermediate and high greenhouse gas emission scenarios. What does your new study find, and what in your approach makes a difference?
Yeah, so the quote from the IPCC report that you just quoted, that goes back to looking at the climate model simulations directly. So for every IPCC report, there's a dedicated set of climate model simulations being carried out, and those are then being analyzed in order to understand what will happen in the future in every aspect of our climate system. But I should say already, when writing the IPCC report, we were aware of the fact that these models were losing their ice too slowly, in particular relative to global warming. So in the real world, in the observational record that we have, we lose about 4 million square kilometers of Arctic sea ice per 1 degree of global warming. But in many of the models, we lose much less sea ice per degree of global warming. So we knew already then that the models were losing their ice too slowly. And so what we did in the IPCC report was to try and correct for these issues in an sort of ad hoc way by just selecting a few models and using linear extrapolations, etc., which made us also make this statement in this sort of more specialized chapter of the IPCC report to say that we are pretty certain that the ice will be lost in some summers before 2050 in every scenario. But what is now new in this study, that we've found a way to correct the bias in the model simulations by comparing their past simulation of the sea ice record to what we have observed. And by then analyzing how quickly the models lose their ice, how quickly it was lost in reality, we were able to then bias correct also the future simulations of the sea ice cover. And this then gives us much more confidence that this time period, 2030 to 2050, really is the most likely one for the first ice-free summer in the Arctic.
Why does it matter if the Arctic Ocean becomes open sea sooner, like in the 2030s, instead of 2050 or even 2070, as they used to predict?
Well, I guess it does matter because it shows us how quickly climate change is unfolding. And it also means that almost every person who's alive on this planet today is quite likely to witness an ice-free Arctic throughout their lifetime. And I feel that that one of the problems really in reacting to climate change is that many of the major impacts seem quite remote, either geographically or temporally in time. And so the fact that something will happen in the 2030s, I think really increases the feeling of urgency also when it comes to taking action towards stopping global warming.
Dr. Knotts, will an ice-free summer in the Arctic Sea lead to more global warming itself? Is it a positive feedback effect?
It will lead to more warming, certainly in the Arctic, which is what we term Arctic amplification, the fact that the Arctic is warming more rapidly than other parts of the planet, because the sea ice is a huge sunlight mirror, one could say. And so in summer, when the sunlight is, when the sun is in the sky for 24 hours, much of that sunlight that hits the surface in the Arctic is being reflected back to space by the sea ice cover. And now this sunlight mirror is becoming smaller and smaller and smaller and might eventually disappear. And so more and more and more sunlight stays in the system and heats the Arctic. And that is one of the reasons why the Arctic is heating up more than other parts of the planet. But it's not really a very strong feedback in the sense that this, what scientists call the ice albedo feedback loop, isn't particularly strong when it comes to the loss of Arctic sea ice. So there have, say some 10, 15 years ago, there has been this worry that we might lose Arctic sea ice cover unstoppably simply because we have less ice, more absorption of sunlight, warmer water means less ice, more absorption of sunlight. But this vicious circle is broken every winter. And so it only works in summer when the sun is up in the sky. But in winter, there are feedbacks going the other way around. And this basically stabilizes the sea ice cover to a degree that the loss of sea ice is largely linear relative to both global temperature and to greenhouse gas emissions by us humans. and that there isn't any self-acceleration.
That's a bit of a relief to hear. Now, if it does rebuild every winter, but if there's a summer where it can't build on previous ice because that melted, wouldn't the ice be thinner?
Exactly. And so in the future, with a complete loss of summer sea ice, the ice will be thinner. But I should say that many of these changes in the Arctic have already been unfolding over the past, say, 20, 30 years. So if you look at a map of the age of the sea ice cover in the Arctic in the mid-1980s, you would find that back then, about half of the sea ice was more than 4 years old. So it was circulating in the Arctic Ocean for a couple of years, getting thicker and thicker. The salt would drain out of the ice, and you would get this almost fresh ice near the surface that expeditions could then use to produce their meltwater, their drinking water. But if you look at a map of sea ice age today, you will find that almost all this ice that is like 4 or 3 years old is gone. So already now the sea ice cover in the Arctic is very much younger than it used to be, and this trend will simply continue over the coming years.
Even later this century, though, some scientists expect pockets of sea ice to hang on, say around the Canadian archipelago. What is the technical definition of an ice-free Arctic?
Yes, so what the wording that we've been using for the IPCC report, and that I think is a good description, is that we call our findings practically sea ice-free, and we use a threshold of less than 1 million square kilometer of sea ice. And that is about 10 to 15% of the initial sea ice cover. And this last ice, as you say, will be found at the northern edges of Greenland, some bays in northern Canada. But it's sort of the Arctic Ocean itself is practically ice-free. Say if you want to go to the North Pole with a ship, you wouldn't find ice floes. If you look at the ecosystem side of things, much of the Arctic will be ice-free and not support any ecosystem that needs sea ice. And so therefore we think it's useful to have this definition of a practically ice-free Arctic Ocean once the sea ice cover drops below 1 million square kilometers.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, just during my single lifetime, what was always frozen has become an open ocean at times, stretching 1,500 miles or 2,400 kilometers from Canada all the way to Russia. Do you find that mind-boggling?
I absolutely do. And I think for me, that might be one of the most important impacts of our finding, namely that we're basically communicating that we are losing an entire landscape. And somehow there seems to be something deep within us humans that connects us to this landscape. So I sometimes give talks in kindergartens or preschools or with kids like 4, 5, 6 years old. And when I show them pictures from the Arctic, from my expeditions there, they are absolutely amazed. They are like, are you really going to these places? Have you seen polar bears? And there seems to be something incredibly fascinating about these landscapes rooted deeply within us. And the fact that we are basically making this entire landscape disappear, at least in some summers initially, means that we are losing this kind of fascinating landscape. And somehow I expect this will do something with how we perceive this planet, that the Arctic in the future is just an open ocean like every other. And it really changes, in some sense, I think, our view of this world.
So when was the last time the Arctic was more or less ice-free? Has it been frozen during all the time of Homo sapiens, even during our evolution?
It was probably ice-covered for much of our evolution, if you take the last, say, 200,000 years, because the Arctic has been comparatively cold for the past 4 or 5 million years, also during which time the Greenland ice sheet was building up. And so certainly since humans have existed in, say, Europe, the U.S., Canada, the Arctic was ice-covered all year round.
Is it conceivable most of the Arctic Ocean could be ice-free year-round, and do we know what amount of warming it would take to do that?
That is much more uncertain compared to predicting when the ice might be gone in summer, because the climate models even though they disagree for the summer timing, they disagree even more for the loss of the winter sea ice. But what they all agree on is that we do need substantially more warming than, say, 2 or 2.5 degrees, or 2 degrees as set by the Paris Protocol. But it is, of course, possible that given sufficient warming, the Arctic might eventually become ice-free all year round. In terms of timing, most climate models only see this happening at some point, say, early next century.
Dirk Nautz, does the lack of summer sea ice alter weather patterns or currents of wind or oceans further south?
I think the jury on that one is still open. There are a couple of studies that have suggested that this is the case, and if you take a climate model and you keep everything else constant and you just remove the ice cover, you do see a signal in weather patterns. But a number of other studies have found that in reality the signal is too small to be really visible in all the noise of weather patterns and jet stream wiggles that we usually have anyways. And so there might be some impact, but there many studies have shown that this impact might not stand out from the noise. And so when looking at this in the last IPCC report, we basically said that we have low confidence in our understanding and in the certainty that we really will see a measurable impact of these changes on our weather.
And has seasonally disappearing sea ice contributed to the global trend of ocean warming? We see hotter oceans in the Atlantic and the North Pacific. Will the Arctic Ocean warm, and do those waters interact with that great conveyor belt that adds heat to other oceans?
Yes, the Arctic Ocean certainly is warming because, like physically, as long as you have ice in contact with seawater, the ice is sort of trying to keep the seawater at freezing temperature. But now with longer and longer ice-free periods in larger and larger parts of the ocean, the average temperature of the Arctic Ocean is certainly rising just now. And we also see more what we call marine heat waves. And so basically temperature patterns in the Arctic Ocean that stand out from the internal variability or natural variability of ocean temperatures. However, the connection between the Arctic Ocean and the rest of the world's ocean isn't particularly strong when it comes to its temperature. More important, however, is the freshwater export from the Arctic into the Fram Strait, into the region east of Greenland and around Greenland, because there a lot of so-called deep water is being formed. And so only in the polar regions does the seawater become so dense, because it's both cold and salty, that it can sink all the way to the seafloor and then from there spread over all the world's ocean near the bottom. And this sinking of the ocean water near Greenland is very sensitive to how much fresh water there is around. And with more melting of sea ice, with more inflow from large rivers into the Arctic Ocean is freshening. And thus, this might contribute to a bit of the weakening of the ocean circulation that we are expecting in the North Atlantic throughout the century.
But that's the ocean circulation that keeps Germany and England much warmer than they would be for the latitude where you are.
Indeed. So we're not expecting this circulation to break down altogether. We expect probably a weakening of about 30%. There is a small chance that it might collapse the circulation because also their models have problems in reproducing the processes that we think are really important, which also means that you look at maps of global warming. The global warming is often weakest in the North Atlantic because you reduce the inflow of warm water from further south with the slowdown of this ocean circulation. So we still have warming everywhere. It's just somewhat weaker potentially in the North Atlantic and then maybe in Ireland and Iceland.
Do we really know all the ramifications of early sea ice loss in the Arctic? Could this trigger a system elsewhere on the planet? Are there teleconnections with things like rainfall in the Amazon or wildfires in North America?
I would be surprised if we would find anything like that because for the climate system, there isn't anything particularly special about even losing the last ice floe in the Arctic, because for the climate system, we have already lost half of the sea ice cover in the Arctic. And one could imagine that the impact of this first half is roughly equally large as losing the second half as well. There could, of course, be surprises, but because of the jet stream and other phenomena, the Arctic is a bit isolated from the rest of our planet, both in terms of its connection to the world's ocean, but also in the atmosphere, where we certainly do have connections, but I personally do not expect any major impacts from this loss of summer sea ice on sort of the major weather patterns that we have further south. There is, of course, this possibility, but we have relatively weak evidence in that direction.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Arctic sea ice may disappear in summer in the next 10 years. Alex talks with ice expert Dirk Knotts from the University of Hamburg.
Your team doesn't suggest we try to save the sea ice with geoengineering, like blasting sulfur into the stratosphere over the far north. Why not?
We haven't really looked into sort of ways of potentially saving the ice, and I'm certainly not an expert on geoengineering. And my take on geoengineering is that much of that, whether we do it or whether we don't do it, at the end of the day, will be a societal decision. But the problem that I know with many of the geoengineering methods suggested is that they usually have adverse side effects, negative side effects, and at least some other parts maybe of the planet. And so at the end, deciding as to how we potentially might change the climate or how we want to affect the climate will be politically extremely difficult to sort out. And so even if we were to stabilize the global mean temperature by putting solar mirrors into the space, it would be a different climate in many regions of the world, even though the average it would be the same. So in that sense, I think we are currently doing geoengineering in the sense of putting a lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and by that way changing the climate through technical methods. And I think the only technique that we can agree on that would make sense would be to reverse this geoengineering that we're currently carrying out by putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere by trying to remove them again and store them at somewhere underground, for example.
And the new study says the early arrival of a seasonally open Arctic sea means humanity needs to plan and to adapt to a new reality. What plans could we make? How could we adapt?
Well, I guess the primary impacts of an ice-free Arctic Ocean will be for the people who live in the Arctic, but many of them are already adjusting to the new reality of having much longer ice-free periods in summer, having winters where ice might not form where it used to form. For example, in Greenland, I've talked to some of the hunters there who told me that they are not using their dog sledges anymore because there's no safe sea ice to travel on anymore. So they just go fishing all winter round. And so in that sense, they are already adapting. But of course, given the current tensions that we have, the fact that suddenly in the Arctic, the states that border the Arctic, including Russia, including the U.S. with Alaska, including Canada, including the European countries, if there suddenly is completely open water in summer, it of course means that there is much easier connection also between these countries. And I guess also in that direction, there already is a lot of planning happening that we probably don't know about.
You know, it seems to me this paper in Nature is part of a newer process I'm seeing in science. In the 1990s, we did not have enough data, so scientists depended heavily on climate models alone. With three decades under our belts and more sophisticated sensors, there is a better chance to compare model results with the observed record. And that's really what you've done in this paper, isn't it? Do you see it as a change in climate science?
Yes, absolutely. Also, some of the earlier studies that I've been involved in, where we found a very, very clear linear relationship between the Arctic sea ice cover and CO2 emissions, which allowed us to calculate that for each metric ton of CO2 that a person emits, about 3 square meters of Arctic sea ice disappear. That number and that finding was primarily based on the observational record. And so the only information we took from the climate models for this study was the fact that this linearity also exists in every climate model and basically will be kept up until all the ice is gone. So we basically can extrapolate the observed record into the future to get some estimate of when the Arctic will be ice-free. And the fact that we now have a much longer record also means that we can much clearer identify those models that really have problems when simulating Arctic sea ice and those that seem to do an okay job. Because, of course, always when it comes to analyzing model simulations, we do have the large problem of internal variability, chaotic changes in the climate system that happen on top of the very clear signal of anthropogenic warming that we, of course, identify in every model simulation.
You have been researching sea ice for more than a decade, publishing many papers. What do you think is left to be done?
Well, I think from my perspective, the real big questions when it comes to sea ice research currently are emerging in the Southern Ocean. Because in the Southern Ocean, we have a situation that we there have a lot of sea ice in winter and very little in summer. And so in some sense, the Arctic is getting more like the Antarctic in the sense of having very, very little ice in summer and still a lot in winter. But the models are doing a terrible job in some sense to project what is happening there. So, for example, we had no real ice loss in the Antarctic, which we think is connected to the fact that in the Antarctic, the amount of sea ice area that we have, it's much closer linked to the wind patterns that we have compared to the Arctic. Because in the Arctic, the ice is landlocked, so it can't go anywhere, no matter how the winds blow. And so in the Arctic, the amount of sea ice primarily depends on the freezing and melting in the central Arctic Ocean, or in the Arctic Ocean itself. But in the Southern Ocean, the winds that blow from the continent, from the Antarctic continent that sits on the South Pole towards north, distributes the Arctic sea ice on the surface of the ocean. And so the amount of sea ice area that we have in the Southern Ocean is much more driven by changes in the wind patterns. And we believe that some of the fact that we have lost very little ice in the Southern Ocean so far has been related to the potential increase of these winds. But now over the past few years, we've seen a strong negative trend of Southern Ocean sea ice coverage. And it is currently unclear if that's sort of just a hiccup in the climate system and that we will go back to the sea ice that we've had before, or whether that's really is the beginning of a real trend in Southern Ocean sea ice. And the problem why we've not been able to simulate sea ice particularly well in the Southern Ocean is that many of the processes there depend on what the ocean does. And the Southern Ocean is characterized by its large amount of small-scale ocean eddies that we couldn't resolve in earlier generations of climate models. But now we are developing higher and higher resolved, spatially resolved climate models. And so it now starts to become possible to also get faithful simulations of the Southern Ocean.
From the Institute of Oceanography at Hamburg University, we've been speaking with sea ice specialist Professor Dirk Knotts. He is co-author of Breaking Science, published in the journal Nature Communications. The title is Observationally Constrained Projections of an Ice-Free Arctic, Even Under a Low Emission Scenario. Find links to that open access paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Dirk Knotts, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
As you heard, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres just demanded oil companies stop investing in new supplies of climate-killing carbon. They need to wind down those operations and find a new business model in sustainable energy. But you might as well ask a fentanyl addict to switch to yoga. They have just gone out to get us more deadly drugs. Fossil fuel industries claim greater demand forces investing all their recent big profits into even more production. We just had two interviews reporting on the splurge of fossil fuel investments by the biggest banks and private investment firms. April Merlot from Rainforest Action Network named the big banks lending billions for new drilling, mining, and fracking. Then Katrin Ganswind from the German group Urgewald revealed the investment companies putting trillions more to expand fossil fuel production. It's the exact opposite of what we need to do. You can find those interviews free at ecoshock.org. Take the case of so-called natural gas. It is just methane, and in America, 80% of it comes from fracking. Of course, blowing up the underground, injecting super toxic and radioactive chemicals to get those bubbles of gas broken up, well, nothing could be more natural than that, right? That is where we need Greg Aitken. As Europe scrambles for gas, Greg is editor of the weekly Inside Gas Bulletin for the NGO Global Energy Monitor. This free bulletin is like an industry insider about projects that every community and activist should know about. This interview was tough technically. The phone line to the Czech Republic was poor and disconnected Greg and I at least four times. We made it happen, and I may have to interrupt now and then if a clarification is needed. Listen carefully, though. You will hear how the gas industry is ramping up methane production to save the world from climate change, apparently. Even former green voices like Germany now have methane madness. From Brno in the Czech Republic, Greg Aitken, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi there.
Hi. So tell us about the scramble for natural gas in Europe after the sudden decline of Russian supply.
Yeah, well, obviously, last year, after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there was a big emergency situation where EU member states that had long been very dependent on Russian gas imports. Well, first of all, there were several countries that had their supplies cut off by Russia. But Germany was facing the problem because Russia was starting to reduce flows through the Nord Stream 1 gas pipeline, which has been operating for quite some time. So really, there was just a big rush for Europe to diversify away from Russian imports. And this was also a move that was taken forward by the European Commission, which introduced a program called the Repower EU plan, which essentially was looking to set targets for diversifying from Russian gas and also to be looking at energy-saving measures, basically reducing Europe's use of or consumption of gas out to 2030, which was tying in with longer plans in the making from Europe to get off gas. But the short-term effect was to really go for this huge scramble for gas, and European buyers really switched their thoughts to LNG. Now, Europe has had, over the last 15 or so years, quite a number of LNG import terminals, which hadn't, until recently, really been working at full capacity. Because of the rush for new LNG from the likes of the US, also from Africa, from the Middle East, these existing terminals started to be operating at much closer to full capacity. And alongside that, there was a lot of rapid planning of developing new terminals. And a whole raft of new projects were proposed. Quite a few were up and running within about 6 months of the war. Some new floating import terminals in the Netherlands, and others have been planned and have been set in motion. And Germany has been the main focus for the new import terminal build-out. It has currently made operational three new terminals in about the space of a year, and has six or seven which are currently being planned or are under construction. So it's basically just been a huge effort to scour the globe looking for new gas supplies, which has been difficult because generally we're in a tight global gas supply period at the moment. And so the result was last summer to see skyrocketing gas prices, which also had major impacts on other countries, particularly developing world countries, where the huge prices caused major problems for gas supply to these countries. Pakistan, Bangladesh, other countries in Southeast Asia, which over the course of last year saw quite lengthy power blackouts, which were damaging for the economy, for society and so forth. So there have been many kind of knock-on effects from Europe's mad dash for gas.
You know, Russia would have been sending a lot of gas to Europe and other trading partners, and now it can't. What is it doing with the gas?
Well, it's trying its best to forge new deals with the likes of China, with a couple of major pipeline deals, which appear to be moving forward quite slowly. Russia is also currently making efforts to talk to other countries in Southeast Asia for cementing new longer-term deals. At the same time, an interesting aspect in the whole Russian situation is not all pipeline gas from Russia has to the EU has been cut off. Some is still coming through a couple of pipelines and also, interestingly, through a transit route in Ukraine. But one of the more embarrassing things, I think, for the European Union has been that supplies of Russian LNG have been coming through still to European ports. And there hasn't been, unlike with oil and other Russian products, there hasn't been a concerted effort to sanction Russian LNG flows, for example. So as far as I know, there is a lot of Russian gas which is not being exported at all and is looking to be used, I think, for new projects in Russia. But it's been trying to diversify its exports, but it's fairly slow progress at the moment. But it's certainly, I think, aware that the writing is on the wall for Europe, for exporting to Europe longer term.
Well, natural gas, as it's called, is really methane, mostly methane. In your view, Greg, is the global natural gas industry expanding production, or is it just rearranging existing markets?
That's a very wide question. Just this week, for example, Shell is holding a kind of an investor day in New York where it is about to tell the investment community that it regards gas as more than just the transition fuel, which we've heard about for the last 10 years, but Shell is reportedly set to commit to increasing its investments in upstream exploration and production. Similar noises have been made from the likes of Chevron in recent weeks. And so the oil and gas majors are certainly winding back from the transition policies which have been in place for the last few years. And I think bowing to the investor pressure that they've felt for this. At the same time, as we come up to another climate summit in United Arab Emirates in November, I think there's alarm being raised at the fact that conference is obviously being led by a major petrol state with also huge gas interests. And I think climate groups are alarmed at basically the fact that getting phase-out commitments from countries so far hasn't materialized. It has materialized for coal, but there's nothing on paper or has been agreed to actually to get to a phase-out agreement for oil and gas. So it's difficult to say whether gas production is being expanded, but certainly there doesn't appear to be any quieting of new announcements for new exploration and production investments, even though the International Energy Agency 2 years ago under its net zero emission scenario was saying there is no more room as of 2022 for new production. So it's not looking great, I would have to say.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest Greg Aiken from the Global Energy Monitor. Greg specializes in tracking world gas production. Do you know what percentage of gas is fracked compared to the old style wells? I was just wondering.
I have to say that's difficult to know, really. I'm aware that obviously fracking is predominantly major technique used in North America, USA and Canada. According to the U.S. Energy Administration statistics for 2022, 80% of U.S. gas production came from shale formations. So, you know, that suggests that fracking was used for around about 80% in the U.S. Globally, I wouldn't be able to put a figure on it.
Well, I've heard that fracking is spreading to other parts of the world. Australia, Poland's talked about whether they have frackable reserves. It could spread and become a worldwide phenomenon.
Well, over the last 10 years or so, there's been a lot of speculation about fracking development globally. Australia, as you say, is one country where there have been some new developments. Argentina as well, with Vaca Muerta, major shale formation in that country where some fracking is taking place, and there are proposals for more. Generally, though, in many places that there have been moratoria put in place by national governments banning fracking. In Europe, there was a lot of fracking hype about 10 years ago, but fundamentally, the issue in Europe is much more densely populated continents and really limited water supplies, limited land available to carry out a practice which is widely regarded as being highly destructive and resource intense.
As we know, Poland built an industrial economy on coal, and now it seems everyone from the European Union to the United States will help Poland finance gas to just stop those coal emissions. Talk to us about gas politics and the outlook in Poland.
One of the interesting things about Poland is that because in the European Union context, because Poland has been really so much the bad boy in terms of its coal industry, obviously it's a decade-long industry which has, you know, dominated Polish society for a long time, but Poland has really been dragged kicking and screaming by the European Commission to make some concessions that the coal industry will have to decline. And so as a result of that, when it comes to Polish gas ambitions, what I've heard from colleagues in Brussels is that the European Commission is rather relieved if Poland budges at all from coal. The plans for gas expansion, despite the EU's commitments to reduce gas consumption by 2030 and thereafter, Polish gas ambitions are somehow being tolerated. They have one LNG import terminal operational. They have plans for a couple more terminals. And I think also as well, in a recent deal last week, which was agreed by the US, a US government bank, it agreed to guarantee a $500 million financial deal, which allows one of Poland's biggest energy companies to import US LNG. So there are certainly political elements to the likes of Poland being permitted to get off coal via gas. But at the same time, Poland has a wealth of renewables potential, especially offshore in the Baltic Sea. The question really has to be asked of all the EU member states which have signed up to EU greenhouse gas emission reduction targets is, how long do you really want to lock in your economies to gas when you're legally obliged to be reducing your emissions?
We still hear gas promoted as a greenish bridge to a low-carbon future. Do you personally think there's enough room in the atmosphere for another few decades of burning gas?
I think gas will have to feature, and it can't be knocked out by 2030 or 2040. And I think most low-carbon scenarios see a role for gas out to 2050 and quite possibly beyond. It's just a worry and a concern that investments that are being lined up now, which are multi-decades in terms of how long they will potentially run for, that including gas, which obviously involves the combustion of methane, which is, and also much leaking methane leakage, that the prospects are, unless more and more of these investments are restricted, that we are going to blow the carbon budget because of gas.
Has any country or institution gone so far to declare methane gas is a clean, green energy?
Yeah, well, in various ways, this is still happening. In the last month or so, in Mexico, gas-fired power was reclassified by the government as clean, for instance. In the last 6 months, in several U.S. states, there have been legislative moves to call gas clean and sustainable. One of the most kind of fought over issues in Europe in the last couple of years regarded the European Union's so-called taxonomy for financially sustainable investments. And the EU, despite much pressure and despite much protest from climate groups and scientists as well, it decided to label gas as a sustainable source of energy. It's still happening.
And tell us about the UK's advertising watchdog banning big energy greenwashing that was being pumped out on the media.
Yes, well, this is part of a growing concern internationally about greenwashing claims for products of all kinds, but also marketing campaigns that are coming from major oil and gas firms. And the UK watchdog, which I think is currently drawing up new standards for what is permissible for companies to accurately show what they're doing, it took action in the last couple of weeks against Shell and against a couple of other foreign companies, which, as one sees very often, are very much heavily promoting the clean side of their businesses with electric charging points for vehicles and other nice things, which make up a minuscule percentage of these companies' business models. And the UK watchdog was basically making the point that this is all very well and good, but if you don't put this in the context of what your majority business is doing in terms of not reducing emissions, not planning to curb your production of oil and gas, then essentially you're misleading customers. So the prescription was to ban certain campaigns, particularly one from Shell.
We've been speaking with Greg Aitken, editor of Inside Gas Bulletin. Find it at www.globalenergymonitor.org. You can also find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Greg, thank you for helping us out.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Next week, we talk with Dr. Peter Carter, the medical doctor who now tries to heal the world's climate. Peter tells it like it is, and then backs all that up with climate science. I also hope to speak with Australian military analyst Elizabeth Bolton. She is telling militaries, including the U.S. Marine Corps, around the world to prepare for social chaos as climate change goes off the rails. My thanks to all the volunteers and dedicated people making nonprofit radio happen and the 106 stations that play this show. Be sure to join us again next week. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. John Pilger on depleted uranium in Ukraine. First the UK, now the Biden administration, are planning on sending depleted uranium tank shells to Ukraine. When the UK Ministry of Defence, MOD, made the announcement on March 20 of this year, peace groups and investigative reporters raised the alarm. Toxic and radioactive uranium dust appears when these DU shells are detonated,
They pose a danger to the health of anyone who inhales it, and they contaminate the soil and water. The investigative reporter and documentary filmmaker John Pilger remembers the devastating effects the DU shells had when they were used in Iraq. Soldiers burned alive in their tanks when these new armor-piercing DU shells hit them. The British Forces Broadcasting Service has a description for their military audience.
DU, as it's known, is a byproduct of nuclear enrichment, the process that's used to make nuclear fuel and nuclear weapons. It's used to make tank shells because it's so hard. At the same speed, depleted uranium rounds are up to 20% more effective than older tungsten ones. Conventional tungsten ammunition deforms when it hits metal, making it progressively blunter. Depleted uranium rounds, on the other hand, sharpen as they travel through, giving them greater punch. As it bores through, the DU penetrator also pushes in the tank's own armor. The crew inside then face not just a high-velocity projectile, but also fragments of their own vehicle, all ricocheting around their confined space at deadly speed. To make things worse, depleted uranium ignites when it's exposed to oxygen, creating fire and potentially cooking off ammunition and fuel inside the tank. For the crew, the effects can be catastrophic. Depleted uranium rounds were first used during the Gulf War by both British and American forces. In the years that followed, there's been a lot of controversy, with claims their use causes long-term health damage and contaminates the environment. Both the UK MOD and the US Department of Defense dispute that, though, claiming independent scientific research has shown there to be no link between depleted uranium and human cancer. Simon Newton, Forces News.
That's from the British Forces Broadcasting Service. In conversation with John Pilger is Phil Miller, chief reporter for Declassified UK. Miller is reporting on the growing number of cases in European courts brought by soldiers who were sickened after serving in Iraq or NATO wars in the former Yugoslavia. On June 13, 2023, the Wall Street Journal broke the news that the Biden administration is planning to equip the Abrams tanks they are sending to Ukraine with depleted uranium shells.
New reports suggest the U.S. could be gearing up to provide Kyiv with depleted uranium, DU, tank ammunition. Unnamed U.S. officials told the Wall Street Journal on Monday that Washington is set to send DU ammunition to Ukraine, which would be fired from U.S.-provided Abrams tanks. There are no significant hurdles to the U.S. sending DU ammunition, a senior administration official told the publication. But the move has nonetheless angered Russian President Vladimir Putin, who suggested there was a nuclear element to the move.
That's the Wall Street Journal. Now it remains to be seen if there is resistance to this decision in the U.S., or at least curiosity about the news, as shown by John Pilger and Phil Miller on this consortium news video. Elizabeth Voss is hosting. She's joined by Joe Loria, editor of Consortium News. The date was May 11, 2023.
Welcome to CN Live, Season 5, Episode 7. Depleted uranium shells have been sent to Ukraine, as confirmed by UK Armed Forces Minister James Heapy last week. Britain announced last month that it would send the munitions for use with Challenger 2 tanks in Ukraine, a move that immediately escalated nuclear tensions with Russian President Vladimir Putin threatening to place tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus just days later. The UK move comes amid indications that Kyiv is increasingly desperate to the point of being willing to risk scorching the earth it is fighting for. Over the last few months, documents emerging as part of the Pentagon leak have shown Ukrainian forces are faring far worse than previously reported by corporate media.
Britain's decision to send depleted uranium rounds to Ukraine represents more than a dangerous escalation in the West's proxy war with a nuclear-armed power. It's an example of Ukraine's willingness to target the ethnic Russian population in eastern Ukraine and poison the land it is attempting to retain, but according to the Pentagon leaks, knows it won't be able to. Depleted uranium will have effects not only on Russian fighters and possibly Ukrainian soldiers too, but also on the civilian population for years to come. The U.S. and British corporate media appear to dismiss concerns of Russian nuclear escalation in response to the use of depleted uranium rounds, and the official line in the West is that such weapons represent a low environmental risk.
However, there are compelling reasons to question the official stance. Depleted uranium rounds were used by U.S. forces in both Iraq wars as well as the Balkans in the 1990s. Depleted uranium munitions are heavier than lead and are typically used to pierce the armor of tanks. On impact, the metal shears, burns, and vaporizes, producing radioactive dust. A 1999 report by The Guardian related the sentiments of scientists speaking in regards to Kosovo with depleted uranium, saying, quote, one single particle of depleted uranium lodged in a lymph node can devastate the entire immune system.
In John Pilger's film documenting Iraq after the first war, Paying the Price, Killing the Children of Iraq, he spoke with doctors in Basra, where they reported a tenfold increase in cancer deaths. Pilcher also spoke with an Iraqi pediatrician who described an influx of congenital deformities never seen before the war. In the case of the second Iraq war, the most striking reported effects of depleted uranium and other toxic substances was seen in Fallujah, where U.S. forces bombed mercilessly in 2004. The rise in birth defects in Iraq has been called catastrophic, and The Guardian went so far as to publish a piece in 2014 that accused the World Health Organization of covering up the, quote, nuclear nightmare left behind in Fallujah by the U.S. and U.K. Others have compared the city's health crisis with that following the U.S. nuclear attack in Hiroshima. Is this the future faced by generations of ethnic Russians in Ukraine?
With Ukraine set to lose if slowly on the battlefield, what is to be gained by taking out a few more Russian tanks if it permanently renders the land a danger to its inhabitants, permeated with toxic dust particles of radioactive heavy metal? How can this decision be viewed as anything but a spiteful admission that the land is being lost and that salting it is a final act of malice against ethnic Russians in Donbass? To discuss this with us tonight, we're joined by John Pilger in Australia. John is an eminent journalist and documentary filmmaker who has twice won Britain's highest award for journalism and has been International Reporter of the Year, News Reporter of the Year, and Descriptive Writer of the Year. He's made 61 documentary films and has won an Emmy, a BAFTA, and the Royal Television Society Prize. His Cambodia Year Zero is named as one of the 10 most important films of the 20th century. And we're also joined by Phil Miller in London. Phil is a declassified UK's chief reporter and the author of Keeney Meany, The British Mercenaries Who Got Away with War Crimes. He has been covering the UK decision to send depleted uranium to Ukraine and recently published an article covering court cases that linked depleted uranium exposure to service members in Europe who later developed cancer. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Very welcome.
John, I'd like to start with you. Can you just tell us what you experienced in Iraq firsthand in documenting the effects of the Gulf War on civilians in Iraq?
In southern Iraq, where I was right at the end of the first Gulf War, you may remember the terrible road of death, which the Iraqi army tried to escape the wrath of the US in Kuwait. And miles and miles of vehicles of fleeing Iraqi military personnel were blown to bits. Most of the ammunition, most of the ordnance used was depleted uranium. And you could tell that from, I inspected the one end of this convoy of death and the holes in the side of armored personnel carriers were those that had been caused by the shells of depleted uranium. I'd seen it elsewhere. Now, right across southern Iraq, depleted uranium was used. And it was used in a way that it had to be there for years and years in the future. Southern Iraq, particularly at that time of the year, is a place of the most terrible sandstorms. The sand blows up, it blows into your eyes, your nose, your throat. Everyone is covered with it. People talk about it. It's part of life there, but it's a terrible part of life. And of course, it carries all the toxics of warfare and particularly of depleted uranium. One of the doctors referred to it as the seeds of death. You can understand why. In the teaching hospital, Sadra Teaching Hospital in Basra, The scene was, well, it was apocalyptic. Mostly children had been affected because children not only play in these toxic sandstorms, they play on the wreckage of war and they can pick this up. When you consider, give you an idea, one of the doctors described it, and I think accurately, as a form of nuclear warfare. An A-10 Warthog fires 4,500 grams of depleted uranium in one shot. The United States used 300 tons of depleted uranium in southern Iraq. The Warthog was the main instrument of delivering this depleted uranium. Children all had something they had never seen before, had hardly seen before, and that is neuroblastoma, a particular cancer that is so rare that in most societies it's always a surprise, as one of the doctors said, to see it. But the pediatrician in charge of wards of children, all with neuroblastoma, had a book, a color album of all the children that she treated. I mean, it was quite clear. This of course, is what the researchers call anecdotal evidence. I would call it journalistic evidence, eyewitness evidence. This is the kind of apocalyptic result of that war that was never really reported widely and has been largely forgotten since then. And the reason it's been forgotten, if I may just add a little more to my answer, Elizabeth, the role of the World Health Organization, in fact, when I was there in 1999, 2000, 2001, the World Health Organization completed a report on depleted uranium. By 2001, refused to release it, censored a lot of it. I interviewed Carl Sikora, who was then the British oncologist who was in charge of the WHO's cancer program. And he had printed quite a bit of the damning bits of this report in Lancet, the medical magazine, and was ordered by the World Health Organization to take it out. This has gone on right through to the end of the what I would call the main war, that is 2003, or the initial parts of the main war, when the WHO issued a preliminary report and then following Fallujah, another report. But all these reports had been doctored. So depleted uranium, really the effects of it in southern Iraq, where the leading doctor in the Sadra Hospital estimated it would affect 48% of the population of southern Iraq. It's really like a Chernobyl.
Wow. And that debate continues. I mean, to this day, you know, upon this news that the UK was sending depleted uranium over to Ukraine, you still have people in the West saying, no, it's basically harmless. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, then you must remember when I first saw it, the so-called sanctions were in place. These were the most, as you'll remember, the most stringent, it's not sanctions, a blockade really of almost everything against Iraq that weakened Iraq and prepared it to be invaded in 2003. And Carl Sikora, the oncologist I'd mentioned, He wrote in the British Medical Journal, quote, requested radiotherapy equipment, chemotherapy drugs and analgesics are consistently blocked by United States and British advisors to the Iraq Sanctions Committee. We were specifically told by the WHO not to talk about the whole Iraq business. The WHO is not an organization that likes to be involved in politics. It's a rather ironic statement at the end. But that blockade was crippling a country. It couldn't. That's why the two UN humanitarian coordinators, Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck, Ryan Halliday called it a genocide, but the UN, in effect, the United States and Britain operated this medieval siege against Iraq. So by the time 2003 came around and the Bush and Blair invasion force turned up, Iraq was on its knees.
Do you have any comment on the current lack of real outrage, even from independent journalism? I mean, there's not, I mean, we have Phil here, but there's not a lot of voices speaking out about this very, you know, stridently, like I would imagine, given the impact of this substance. Do you think that's because people are scared to talk about it in the face of the controversy scientifically?
I don't talk about a lot of things. And that's on the
list. I'm talking about the independent media even. I'm not even talking
I mean, I sometimes think that those of us doing the work I hope we're doing will one day give up asking why the media do certain things. They are part of the problem. And they are the main instrument of propaganda now. I say that not rhetorically, having come from a lifetime in the mainstream media. They are the instrument of propaganda. All spaces of dissent, of sustained factual reporting on an issue such as this are closed. That's really the answer to your question, Elizabeth. But also it comes down to why are the universities so quiet about this? You know, so many of the big universities, I think I know the ones, but I won't name them because I'm not sure, particularly in the United States, were involved in refining depleted uranium. It's a very effective ordnance. It works. In tank battles, it works. It can subdue a major force very effectively. And here we have Ben Wallace, the defense minister in Britain, licensing depleted uranium to go to Ukraine. That means that we're going to have another Iraq in Ukraine.
So I want to turn to you and your article that you published recently with Declassified UK, where you described Italian courts finding and basically validating this link between exposure to DU and cancer suffered by service members who were exposed in Kosovo. Can you walk us through that recent piece and what it means for this discussion?
Yes, thanks, Elizabeth. So I've been looking at both the legal reaction to this issue and also the kind of scientific debate which John touched on. And it's interesting that, you know, even though among some of the scientific papers there's this degree of ambiguity because of the difficulties of doing long-term studies in war zones, in the legal sphere there are hundreds of court judgments in Europe, mainly in Italy, but also we found one in France and one in England, where judges have awarded compensation to soldiers or soldiers' families after they've passed away because of these rare cancers that have developed after their exposure to depleted uranium ammunition. This is soldiers who were either handling the ammunition themselves or they were being deployed to areas that had just been strafed by NATO, by the US in Kosovo in particular. So I think this is really interesting, and also it kind of, you know, one of the reactions I've had to these stories is, well, who cares if some Russian soldiers get exposed to depleted uranium in their tanks? I mean, this shows that it's, you know, Ukrainian service personnel as well who are liable to some of the risks involved in this. There's obviously, of course, friendly fire as well, which has happened in these tank battles, in other conflicts. And then, of course, the civilian population living in those areas, either when the shells miss their targets and get buried in the ground, potentially by water sources, or just the wrecks of tanks not being cleared away and you know, children playing on them. And the UK has said that they don't feel any moral obligation to help clear up the depleted uranium shells that it sent to Ukraine after the conflict, or to even publish their firing locations. And that's different to Second Iraq War. The MOD did publish the firing locations and they did say they had a moral obligation to help clean up. Ultimately, they didn't give much aid towards that cleanup. But, you know, I think that the position has hardened even more, and they seem to think that they can get away with it. And, you know, going back to 2003, it did feel like there was a bit more pushback from the scientific community. The Royal Society had done some research into the risk of depleted uranium that the MOD and the Pentagon tried to cite as, you know, saying it was low risk. And the Royal Society scientist behind that research actually came out and said to the Guardian, you know, they're misquoting the research. I've said there should be a lot of caution involved, and we need a long-term study to find out what's going on. What's interesting is fast forward to this year when the UK announced it was going to send the depleted uranium to Ukraine. They referred to this same scientific research. They said, you know, the Royal Society said it's fine. And I contacted the Royal Society and said, when did you last do research on this? And they said, well, we haven't updated our research since 2002 or 2003. It's, you know, our position is the same now as it was then. Mm. But, you know, the rest of the media didn't pick up on that. So I think there are lots of questions that should be being asked about this. And, you know, we have perhaps the scientific research, the long-term studies, you know, there are difficulties around doing those, particularly in places like Iraq, where they're still very unstable. But if you just look at the court judgments, and I'm just talking about courts in NATO states, you know, in Italy, in France, in England. I mean, there's other litigation going on, I think, in Serbia as well, regarding the bombardment of Belgrade as well, where lawyers are trying to build on the Italian cases. And I think even in Kosovo, there's some KLA veterans who, you know, fought on the side of NATO, in particular towns that were heavily bombarded, that have expressed concerns about this. So, you know, that's without even getting into that side of it. You know, obviously anything in the Serbian courts is liable to being dismissed as some kind of Russian propaganda sort of thing. So I just looked at the, you know, Italian courts, French courts, English courts. These are all NATO member states, to see what those judges were saying.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I know that you've also reported on the fact that there's no confirmation that Russia has used depleted uranium itself in the war in Ukraine, although it does possess a stockpile of those types of munitions. You've written that James Heapy told Parliament that the Ministry of Defense is unaware of any credible open source reports of Russia using depleted uranium in Ukraine. Can you just tell us a little bit of that wording as well? Because one of the things that I saw a lot in response to the article we published about this subject was people basically saying, well, Russia's using it. And, you know, your reporting indicates that may not be the case.
Yeah, so this was another thing, you know, the reaction to the first story was there was a Russian news agency article from, I think, 2018 saying that they've upgraded some of their tanks to fire depleted uranium. So lots of people were sharing this on social media in response to our story. An MP asked a question in Parliament saying, you know, does the MOD have any, you know, has Russia used depleted uranium? And I expected them to say yes. And surprisingly, that the answer was, you know, we don't have any open source information to say they have done. And something we've seen throughout this conflict is the MOD has been very quick to declassify any intelligence it receives about Russia, you know, using white phosphorus or anything that's perceived as kind of, you know, something that it can call out Russia on. So the fact that they weren't able to produce any instances of Russia actually firing the depleted uranium that it has in its arsenal, again, was very significant and didn't really get much reaction beyond our article, unfortunately.
Yeah, and you bring up white phosphorus. I think that's important as well. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Is there evidence that Russia has used white phosphorus? Because I think that's controversial as well, as far as I'm aware.
This recent case in Bakhmut of what looks like white phosphorus being fired, and Ben Wallace gave a statement to Parliament today where he did say, you know, using white phosphorus in civilian areas is illegal. But some of other research at Declassified has been looking at how Britain fires white phosphorus in Kenya, where it has a military base and it has access to large parts of the Kenyan countryside. And it says that's legal because it's not being fired in a populated area. But I mean, I've been to those areas, I've spoken to the Samburu tribe and the herders who frequent that area. And it's, you know, it's a nomadic area. There's no fence around this firing range, so people are just wandering through. And there are real concerns there about, you know, the health consequences of that. They've also fired faulty ammunition that hasn't exploded, and then herders have subsequently picked it up or stepped on it, and there have been huge numbers of limbs being lost and people even being killed from that, going up as recently as, I think, 2015. Again, I mean, there's so many double standards here. The UK doesn't really seem to be interested in the real risk of using these munitions.
John, did you want to jump in?
It's interesting that the only time I think the US and therefore the UK has said that they have actually used depleted uranium was when the Dutch government extraordinarily got from the United States, the Defense Department, the coordinates of the use of depleted uranium in Iraq. And it did so under pressure from the Dutch anti-war group, PACS, which had brought in a freedom of information thing. What those coordinates showed was that certainly the US had used it widely all over southern and central Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the exact kind of sequence of events as to how the firing locations came to be published. I think the US were much more reluctant than the UK to release where they had fired their munitions. And of course, the US had fired far, far more. So we do have a data set of where the UK fired them in Basra in 2003, but I don't think we have the whole picture, and certainly not the US side of it. You know, the UK is really kind of an outlier here in its use of the weapon. I mean, together with the US, I think on this issue, it's probably in the UK, it's had the most kind of backlash. There's been almost uniform support towards the UK government's policy on Ukraine. And this is probably one of the first issues that's made people start to think, you know, whose interests are we really serving here? And if this is going to spread toxic metal across Ukraine, you know, do we really have Ukraine's best interests at heart here? So I think it started to get people to think a little bit. And then we've had the Pentagon Papers as well, which highlighted more about British troops being on the ground and, you know, the near miss, the spy planes over the Black Sea, and how close some of those near misses have been. So maybe, you know, the war's been going on for over a year now, people might be willing to start thinking a bit more about whether really they're being given the full picture and whether this really can only end in one way, or whether a peaceful solution is possible.
That was a conversation about depleted uranium munitions that many want to see banned under international law. You can find the full video on the Consortium News website or on YouTube under the title DU in Ukraine, John Pilger and Phil Miller. Thanks to Elizabeth Voss, host of CN Live, and Joe Lauria, editor of Consortium News. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelardin. Thank you for listening.